So let's get started with the stuff from today. And what we're doing is we're finishing up chapter 2 on manifolds, and the last stuff on manifolds is basically getting into differential forms, which I'm willing to bet nobody here has ever had a course on differential forms. Yeah. So that's one reason why I handed out all the extra stuff. And I'm gonna talk about it here, and it's gonna be kind of the Sean Carroll point of view on it, and then you've gotten the Jules Ladner point of view from that handout from the other day, and you got two other points of view from the other stuff I just handed out. This one, the teaching electromagnetic field theory, and the other one is from a class at MIT. You know, they should basically give you the full picture of what's going on with it. And by the way, don't feel bad if you don't understand this stuff 100%, because, you know, keep in mind, if you can go back in time and understand this stuff completely at the level that we're going to talk about it through the course of this semester, you know, that's a Nobel Prize in it for you. So that's, you know, so it's not to say you have to understand it completely, but
only if you want to know your
part. Yeah. From back in the 1950s or whatever. Yeah, if you can go back to, 1914 and understand all this stuff, you'll just blow everybody's mind.
Last night on PBS, they had a show on the Palomar Observatory in California. Hale. Mm-hmm. And Einstein went to one of the presentations of this. And
yeah.
He says, "What do you guys do when you make a mistake?" I just erase a couple lines because it's like 100 tons of support structure. Who else saw that? Nobody else? That was just the difference between being a theoretical physicist and a practical astronomer.
Yeah.
Oh, I just erased a couple lines.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, speaking of going back in time, today's lecture we're going to talk about how to do that. So, okay.
Just get in the time machine.
Yeah.
Crank it up to full power.
Well, see, this is the problem. We have to build the time machine at this point. Either that, or you got to hope you did build one in the future and you're going to come back and share that knowledge with yourself. But either way, you're going to have to sit through the class. So... Yeah. Okay. All right. So what we're going to do is start off with an example of a physical manifold, and that is going to be the expanding universe. And hopefully, if we have time this semester, we get to cosmology, and we'll actually get to go a lot more into detail on this stuff. And so you start off with a four-dimensional space-time. And it's going to be a four-dimensional expanding space-time, basically expanding in space at least. So we put in the scale factor, and we just have it multiplying all the spatial components here, and it's a function of time. So as time goes up, this thing gets bigger. As time goes down, it gets smaller, and you end up having either the beginning of the universe or, you know, much later on. And so... you assume then that space is an expanding, flat, three-dimensional Euclidean space. Because at any time, you can kind of rescale the universe, and you could rescale time and space in order to make it look flat. And say A is equal to 1. Yeah?
I don't think it'll make a lot of difference, but could you try messing with the focus a little bit?
Okay.
I mean, I realize I have my notes here. I can look.
This is the autofocus.
That's better.
Okay. All right. So that's better. So what happens is you can think of having all these co-moving world lines, where the world line represents the path of all the particles traveling through space-time. And they're going to remain at constant spatial coordinates, where we're going to say x of I, where the spatial coordinates, and they're just going to move forward in time. Then, if you assume that your scale factor goes like t to the q, where q is some number between 0 and 1, you can create either a matter-dominated or a radiation-dominated universe, flat universe. And Q equals 2/3 would be matter dominated. Q equals 1/2 is radiation dominated. And this is pretty much a very, very simple model of cosmology where we're not taking into account, you know, a cosmological constant or perturbations or, any of the fancy stuff.
What do they mean by matter dominated, radiation dominated? What is the significance of 2/3?
Oh, that's a good question. Matter dominated basically means that the expansion rate of the universe is dictated by matter gravitating in on itself. So there's more, you can almost picture the universe as being made out of more dust and less like pressure, fluid that has a pressure to it. Radiation dominated means that the radiation, everything is so hot that the black body radiation of all that matter is affecting the curvature of the universe. So it's basically the universe when it's really young and really hot would be radiation dominated. So the idea is that the universe actually went from a radiation dominated to matter dominated state at some point.
So what do they call Q?
Q is, I'm not sure what the technical definition of it is, but Q would just be just a little term in here that allows you to switch between one and the other. And what happens is you can actually calculate 2/3 or 1/3 here by essentially taking this metric and solving Einstein's equations with this metric and then finding out what is the stress energy tensor on the right-hand side of Einstein's equation look like. And when you solve, you know, equate both sides, you'll end up with, for if matter is dominating that stress energy tensor and you have like a universe full of dust, for example, you get something like 2/3. If you have a radiation dominated universe with a radiation dominated stress energy tensor on the right hand side of Einstein's equations, you solve everything, you'll get 1/2. So this is just skipping all the steps of solving Einstein's equation. Yeah?
I realize you wrote 2/3 and 1/2. One time you said 1/3. So it's the 1/2.
Oh, sorry. It is 1/2, not 1/3.
Okay.
That was just me not reading my own writing.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure, was it typo or a speco?
Yeah, speco.
And why is Q between 0 and 1?
Because that's what it is in real life.
Okay, what would happen if it was greater than 1?
Okay, let's say it was 2. Then that means the scale factor would increase with time squared, which means the universe would expand too fast. And so if it was greater than 1, the universe is expanding too fast and things don't quite work. Like if you go back to the inflationary period of the universe, the scale factor expanded exponentially, which meant that Q would have been really, really big. And then that introduces you to a whole different stress energy tensor that you'd have to find to make that work. And that's where they get to that whole, it was a magical scalar field that appeared and made everything work.
So I think I heard you say Q was larger at the beginning of the universe.
Mm-hmm.
So we could, so Q could be some continuum, and we happen to be in the zone of it, being 0 or
yeah.
1 right now.
Well, yeah. It could have been like Q went from infinity and shrinks all the way down to 0. Mm-hmm. If that follows the model of the universe, it accurately looks right. Because you keep in mind, if Q was too big, then that means the universe expanded faster. And that means that if you go out and you look through your telescopes, you should see that the universe had expanded at that rate. So a lot of this comes from experimental observations, like, you know, Hubble Space Telescope and the original Hubble, you know, looking through his telescope.
That was on TV last night.
Yeah.
And if Q was less than 0, then the universe would start contracting.
Well, yeah, if Q was less than 0, then the universe would get smaller, and things would be squeezing in on each other. So you can kind of narrow down what Q must be from that, but you can also use theoretical arguments. And so these are basically rough numbers because the universe is never 100% radiation dominated or 100% matter dominated. I mean, it can be matter dominated or radiation dominated, but it's never 100% matter or 100% radiation.
Isn't that the same problem we have with particles and waves?
No, because you can have particles that don't have pressure.
No, I meant the appearance of light looking like a particle or a wave.
Yeah, but even if light looks like a particle, it still has pressure, where dust would not. So, you know, it's kind of like, well, and also this is a classical theory, too, so you're not really thinking about wave-particle duality here. Okay, so the idea is that as the scale factor goes to zero, as t goes to zero, the metric becomes singular because the spatial part disappears, and you have what looks like the Big Bang. And so you can say that the universe goes from t equals zero to t equals infinity. It's just a simple model. Now for light, in the 1 plus 1 dimensions, which means we're just neglecting x, y, and z, we're just looking at light just traveling along one line, then you could say it follows a null geodesic, so you could say that, you know, you have your time and you have your space here, and you could see that you have your scale factor in front of your spatial term, and so you can know that it space-time distance for light is zero, so you can solve for this as a differential equation. And you could see that dx dt must go like this. You integrate this, and you have this big ugly thing which describes t as a function of q. And so you can plug in what q is, whether it's matter dominated or radiation dominated, and you get how far light moves through this expanding universe with respect to time. And so the figure you get from that is this figure 22, and this is on the top of page 78 in your book. And you can see here that you have these two light cones next to each other. And they're not simple light cones where x and y are just, you know, moving along straight lines. What happens here is that they kind of have a bow to them. And so at the singularity at the beginning, the light actually goes completely tangent to the spatial direction.
What's the horizontal axis? Is that space?
The horizontal axis would be space. This would be x. And the vertical axis would be t. So it's really weird, but it's almost like at the beginning of the universe, light didn't travel in time. It just moved in space along the horizontal axis. And then as time moved on, it moved up and kind of went to like a 45-degree angle and then a little bit beyond that until it's going up more perpendicular in time than in space. So it's almost like it went from being horizontal to, if you wait long enough, it'll just go vertical. And so this is what light cones would look like in that universe. So the things to note about this is, first off, the light cones are tangent to the singularity at t equals zero, which is weird. You wouldn't think that light would be traveling like that. Also, the light cones from different points may not intersect in the past. Because, I mean, unless you count the singularity as everybody's past, in which case back then, maybe they intersected, but really the laws of physics broke down, so you can't really say that. So you could see here that if you take light from this point, and light from this point, and you go back far enough in the past, since time stops at t equals zero, that light may have never crossed. And this is sort of one of these things why they had this big problem in cosmology of, you know, how it is that the cosmic microwave background radiation is so uniform, because, you know, this light never intersected, it was never in the same place, but yet it's the exact same temperature. Didn't make sense. And you have this thing we call a horizon. And a horizon is basically something outside, it's basically like a cutoff. Where outside of this horizon, the world lines that cannot influence what happens at the event. So, in other words, something, you know, on the other side of the horizon is not in causal contact. And with a black hole, we call it an event horizon because it's basically, You know, when something falls into a black hole, it's completely separated from the rest of the universe. Nothing that happens to it is ever going to affect anybody else. Like, you can go drive 20 miles away and call somebody on your cell phone and tell them what you're seeing. You fall into a black hole, you pull out your cell phone, you're never going to tell anybody. They'll never know what's going on in there. Likewise, with this horizon, what that means is that if you are in this universe here, that you can't tell what's going on over here because this is completely outside of your horizon. These two points were never in causal contact in the past, and they never will be in the future. So literally, there are places in the universe where unless you can figure out how to go faster than the speed of light, you'll never know what's going on over there, and no information from there will ever reach you. And what happens is, as time goes on and our horizon gets bigger, then we can tell more about the universe. But that's why they have this definition of what is the visible universe and what's the universe. Like, if you look through a telescope, you can see, even with the most powerful telescope on the planet or on space, and in perfect conditions, you can see 13.7 billion light years away. You'll never see further than that because light from further out hasn't had time to reach us. So we could say then that's the size of our horizon.
And it probably won't ever reach us.
Well,
the universe keeps expanding.
If it's 13.71 billion years, like what a little billion years past, it'll come in. So it's just a kind of that question of what happens over time. And so, you know, it's like, for example, our sun is 8 light minutes away, which means that if the sun were to disappear, it would take 8 minutes before we figured it out. And so that's sort of like saying there's a horizon that's, you know, this 8 minutes out from the sun, and it just takes that long for it to expand.
So if we can't see further than 15, 7 billion light years, we really don't know how big the universe is. Like, I don't know, for all I know, the Earth is flat and Hawaii doesn't exist out there.
Right.
I can't see it.
Exactly. Except for, you know, in the case of the Earth being flat and Hawaii not existing, you have some kind of insight where you can tell the Earth isn't flat, and you can do some experiment to see that, you know, it does exist. But with the horizon, there is no physical way within the laws of physics we know to even tell. And that's also why it is in physics, we make a lot of assumptions, and we make assumptions without even thinking we're making assumptions. Like, if I tell you the speed of light in a vacuum is 3 × 10⁸ meters per second, I'm only telling you that that is true based on measurements that we've made or measurements we've made on Earth or even measurements we've made in space in the local environment. But if you get out of our solar system, you don't know that's true. You're just assuming it's true.
I just figured out how you could figure out, forgetting that we're on the Earth and you can figure it out. I mean, just pretending you're...
Mm-hmm.
If, you know, there's this thing where if a piece of Hawaii falls off, it'll cause a big tsunami.
Yeah.
Okay, so if a piece of Hawaii falls off, it causes a big tsunami to come in and hit Santa Monica, California, and you would see it, the wave, and the results of the shells up on the high level, blah, blah, blah. So if an event happened out there over the horizon that pushed back over my horizon, then I would get a sort of like problem.
Signal.
A signal.
Yeah, but the problem is that with the horizons with this, it can't. Like, an event out there will not reach us if it's outside of our horizon. So that's the issue here. I mean, with something like Hawaii, it's within our horizon, so we can tell. But it's kind of like inside of a black hole. You know, once you pass the event horizon of a black hole, nobody on the inside can tell you what's going on.
And nobody outside can tell you what's going on.
Until you have a black hole that spits all that stuff out.
Which, as far as we know, you can't.
Well, I thought there was one or two things where a black hole spit out a bunch of
things. Once you've passed the horizon of it, you can't.
No. It's very new.
Yeah.
You're talking about Hawking radiation.
No, something was really observed, like something...
Yeah, it's usually what they've observed is they've observed accretion disks for like material falling into a black hole and spitting out X-rays. And they've talked about Hawking radiation. They've talked about other things. But these are all events that happen just outside our horizon. Okay. So when you're close, but you're not in. When you actually get into it, it doesn't really work that well. But the thing is, and we'll talk about black holes more later, but there are other things out there that you can do with them where you might have, like a wormhole, where you go into a horizon, but there's another horizon you can go out of later on. You may not be in the same place.
For all we know, a black hole is a wormhole.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe.
Yeah. Nobody can go in and check. That's the problem.
That's the problem.
I mean, so at some point, you got to send somebody in to look around.
You just think some descendants will send an instrument into a hole and they'll wait for it to signal. Oh, no.
Or it'll come out next week. Who knows? So anyway, then there's the issue of causality. And causality basically comes from the idea that we're usually solving initial value problems in physics, where we know the state at the beginning at some time, and then we calculate what's going to happen later on. And solving like a wave equation is a good example of that, where you have the boundary for the wave equation, but you put in this initial state, and then you just evolve those equations further on. And so what happens is you can't really say what happens later on without saying what happened earlier. There's always this cause and effect. Causality makes it possible to have definite answers to a question. Because if you go look at Newtonian physics, for example, and you see a cannonball coming in, and it's following a certain trajectory at a certain speed, and you know its mass and everything, you can back calculate exactly where it came from. What happens is that future events depend on the initial conditions and the physical laws of whatever you're dealing with. Usually the only time we really can't get a very good answer to what were the initial conditions is when you're dealing with a chaotic system, in which case there's so many things, it's so complicated, it's hard to tell. You know, it's like unscrambling an egg.
Even with the cannonball example you gave, if you know what the trajectory is, but you don't know if it was launched from this point in the trajectory at one time or at this point or at an earlier time, you don't know how far back.
Right.
Because you don't know what the initial conditions were. You just have to...
Yeah, you can kind of... Yeah, you're right. You can kind of know what path it followed.
You know what path you're going to follow in the future.
Right. You know, it's kind of like, whenever they Defense Department, if they look like ballistic missiles... You know, if anybody ever launched a ballistic missile against the U.S., it's like, we know where it came from. We don't have to guess. It's like it's been followed, it's studied, and then, you know, all the physics behind it. That's pretty easy. But, you know, that's all because of everything has to follow these paths. Now, here's the question. Since general relativity modifies space-time, can you violate causality? Okay.
No.
Well, I'll get to that. So, what we're going to do is we want to be able to evolve matter fields on a fixed space, fixed background. And this fixed background is not space-time itself. And signals are going to travel on time-like or null trajectories. This is the only rule, just like they do normally. And you have this thing called a causal curve, where a causal curve is a curve that follows a time-like or null trajectory, so that it's basically going from the past to the future, and it's not traveling faster than the speed of light, so it still seems reasonable physically. And we're going to call J plus of S, where S is like the length along this causal curve, the causal future, where S is this path that exists on the manifold. And we have this other thing called the chronological future, which is going to be I plus, and also parameterized with S. And it's going to be a set of points that can be reached following a future direction time-like curve. So in other words, J plus is the path that you're necessarily following, or if you, you know, cause, it's a causal future, which means that it has to come in a certain order. I plus is just a path you could follow.
So J plus is kind of like a railroad track, and I plus is...
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a good analogy. So a point P will always be in its causal future, but not necessarily on its own chronological future. It's the way they explain it in the book. So you can also have this thing called achronal, which basically means that if you have this path S, which exists on the manifold, no two points are connected by a time-like curve. So in other words, imagine you've got two different points. They're not connected by a time-like curve. They're connected spatially. And so you can't really go from one to the other. Now, they define this thing called a future domain of dependence, D plus, which is a set of all the different points where every past moving causal curve through P can intersect. And a future Cauchy horizon, H, which is a boundary for this future domain of dependence. And so this is a picture of what this looks like. Sigma here is a hypersurface, and it's going to represent all the different places where you might be in the present. S is this subdomain of this, which is representing, you know, kind of this, all these places where you are. And then if you follow a time-like or null curve, then you could have come from anywhere on S to this point right here. Kind of like the tail end of a light cone. And D plus is the horizon, you know, basically the domain that separates everything here. And H plus is like this Cauchy horizon, which is the boundary. Okay? So the rule is signals can't propagate outside the light cone at any point P. And actually that picture is on the bottom of page 79 here. So if you want to look at that as we're talking about it, you can you know, refer back to it. Signals can't propagate outside the light cone at any point P. And what that means is, you know, you're kind of stuck. You can't, nothing travels faster than the speed of light, so that works. And every curve that you follow has to intersect S, which is why this is done this way, so that if you're here at this point, no matter how you go back, you're always going to intersect S.
And in that figure, are we just dealing with the surfaces, or are we dealing with the volumes too?
It's mostly the surfaces, but you could see that cone, that volume of that cone is like all the different possible paths that you could have followed from S to getting to that point.
So that's your D.
Yeah. And that's within that domain. I guess D would be that domain.
So D can be the surface, but it's also the volume.
Mm-hmm.
The internal volume.
And yeah.
Then H
is the horizon, or the outside.
Right, edge of it.
Right. So all the info at S can be used to predict the situation at P. And the way I like to think about that is if you're doing a numerical simulation on a computer, then what happens when you evolve this stuff is you have all these grid points. And all these grid, you know, imagine all these different grid points in a computer grid. Then what happens is you try to evolve your solution forward in time, you have to take derivatives. And the way you do a derivative is you look at the change going from one point to the next point and so on. So you might use just one point to the right or one point to the left or one point on top or one point on bottom or whatever, or a combination of these. So all the neighbors to this point can be used to define what's going to happen at the next step. Okay? And it's the same thing here, where if you think about it, everything that is within your certain domain, everything that's close enough to you, can affect you when you move up to the next point. In other words, if you are driving in traffic, then somebody getting in a car accident in Tokyo is not going to really change you getting to work on time. But if the car accident right ahead of you, or if the car next to you gets in an accident, that'll affect you. Or even better, a car accident happens 5 miles up the road. And so this causes another car to run into him, which causes more people to slow down and rubberneck as they pass by, or a lane to be closed off or whatever. And there's kind of a ripple effect eventually coming back and affecting you. And what's happening here is we're just focusing on stuff that's close to you, and it's going to affect it. And the further out you go in this cone, the bigger the cone's going to get. So if you're just trying to predict what's going to happen to you 30 seconds in the future, a car accident 10 miles up the road that just happened isn't going to be in this cone. But if you're trying to predict what's going to happen on an hour commute, then this cone gets bigger and bigger and bigger until it encompasses that accident. And then it slows you down. So that's sort of the picture of what's happening here and how all this initial data can affect what's going on. And so you have this full domain of dependence, which is D plus, a union of D plus and D minus, which is basically saying all of the stuff down here, something that happened way down here, affected the stuff that came out here, and all that stuff affected what's going on up here. And so we kind of put the bottom of the thing in it, as well as the top. So we call the Cauchy surface D sigma, which is the entire manifold. So that's all the stuff that's going on at that particular hypersurface at that particular time. And so that's the whole manifold right then. Now, if you say something is globally hyperbolic, that means the space-time has a Cauchy surface, where, you know, you have this kind of... if you basically say that everything within that manifold is something that can either been affected by something in the past or something that's going to affect you in the future. And that's why you say that's the... globally hyperbolic. If there's stuff that's going on in the manifold which is not going to affect you, then it's not a Cauchy surface. Now, the reason why we're talking about this is because we want to talk about closed time-like curves. And a closed time-like curve is a time-like curve that can intersect with its past because of the curvature of the space-time. A good example of that is, they have a little picture here on page 81, where you could see here that all of these time-like curves, they kind of go around in a circle. And so they're following around here, and you could see that each one of them can intersect with its own past. Because you can, if you extend the past light cone out, then the past also includes the future. And you have to curve space-time in just the right way so that you can get a closed time-like curve. And the example they gave is this R cross S1, where S1 is, of course, a circle. And this is a real number. So you put the two together, you get a cylinder. So you have a space-time that's a cylinder. And if you write out a metric that satisfies that, you get this ugly thing. And you could see here you've got the cross terms and you've got the cosine term for the time, and you've got a cosine for the spatial part, and you've got sine terms for the cross terms. If lambda is the inverse cotangent of time, then you could see that as time goes to infinity, or minus infinity, you got zero. If lambda goes to zero, and if time goes to infinity, you get pi. No, I think it's pi, because remember it's going to be sine over cosine. Well, actually, you could do it for both pi or 2 pi, but I think. Well, I think it's, I'm pretty sure it's pi.
What's this in the
book? 81. Yeah, because you really want to have it as inverse. Well, you can always check his typos, too. But I'm pretty sure it's pi, because otherwise you get the same answer with this one. With the, you know, because 2 pi and 0 would be the equivalent to each other. So, as you have t goes from minus infinity to 0, then what happens is the light cones tilt. And that's just following that metric. I mean, you can see that here you have 0, and you go all the way up to or from minus infinity, and then you go all the way up to 0, and you have this tilting going on. And then as you go t greater than 0, then an interesting thing happens. And what happens is, and you can see it here, that as long as time has this negative sign in front of it, that acts like time. And as long as space has a positive sign in front of it, it acts like space, right? But what happens is, if this term goes from minus infinity, so this goes from being a positive number to being zero, then this becomes a singularity and that becomes a singularity. And then if this gets, becomes a negative number, then time becomes space-like, because now it's changed the signature. And space becomes time-like. They switch places. Time becomes space, and space becomes time. And then it's now possible to travel in this circle around here. And so now, instead of traveling, you know, just forward in time, when you go through the light cone, you're actually falling through space.
No change in time.
With no change in time. Or you can go, you can travel backwards and forward in time however you want. The interesting thing is that this is actually what happens inside a black hole, we think. Where actually when you fall through the black hole horizon, time and space, you actually go through a singularity where time and space kind of flip. They both go to zero and then they convert to the other one. And you go from basically being able to control, if you just look at it one dimension, R, you can normally control where you go in R. You can go backwards, forwards, however you want, but you're stuck traveling forward in time. Once you cross the horizon, you can go wherever you want in time, but you can't go back up in space. You're stuck going in R in that same direction. Which is great. I mean, you can do whatever you want. You just can't go back in time to make yourself not go into the black hole.
Because you're already on the
path
that took you through the...
Mm-hmm. So you're stuck following that path. And so that's what happens here. So what happens is that since you're, you know, you're stuck following this path, but you've gone through this surface that caused you to go from time and space from switching. And this happened at t equals zero. So we call t equals zero the Cauchy horizon, because it's a horizon in that time and space flipped after you pass through the horizon. But at the same time, you know, it's like a Cauchy surface, I guess, because everything that happened before and everything happened afterwards, and it contains the entire manifold. So singularities are points not in the manifold, although they can be reached by traveling on a geodesic for a finite distance. So, for example, when you pass from being inside of this black hole, or from outside of black hole to inside, once you get inside, you cross through this horizon. And now, nothing that happens inside affects anything that happens on the outside. You pass through a horizon. A singularity is thought of as sort of that, you know, something that exists either behind the horizon or in the horizon or whatever, but it doesn't actually count as part of the manifold, because a manifold has to be smooth by definition. And so you can say you pass through the singularity and you got to this thing. And so we could say singularities lead to Cauchy horizons, which is a nice thing because it means that you're never going to accidentally fall into one of these horizons and be stuck in a Groundhog Day scenario. I mean, you should see the singularity coming. Everybody, of course, remembers the movie Groundhog Day. One of Bill Murray's best movies, I think. If you don't remember it, you should rent it. Okay, so next thing I want to talk about is back to more mathematics. And then that'll kind of close out this chapter and move on to the next one. So first thing I'm going to do is bring back the Levi-Civita. And we're talking about tensor densities in this. And there's a difference between a tensor density and a tensor, which you'll learn. But the Levi-Civita, as you remember, it's basically this epsilon, and it's either got value of plus 1, minus 1, or 0, depending on the permutations of all the indices. And it is defined to not change under coordinate transformations. Now, one thing about it is you do a coordinate transformation using M as a transformation tensor or whatever, then what happens is when you try to transform it from the prime to the unprime, you basically get the determinant of the metric you're using to transform it, or determinant of the tensor you're using to transform it, times the tensor density. And this is useful because that means that this thing can be used to define a determinant.
Could you help me with the notation? So that's M. That's not a manifold, though.
No, no. M is just a matrix. Matrix or tensor, you can think of it. So it's like the transformation matrix. I'll show you here to be a little bit more clear.
But the epsilon, mu, prime, 1, 2, 3, 4, up to n, that's one big number?
Yeah, those are all the different indices. So you can have a thousand-dimensional one if you want.
There's no plus sign there.
No, they're just indices.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm just instead of having them calling them like alpha, beta, gamma, rho, whatever, it's just easier to just put little subscripts on them. Also, it requires less creativity.
Subscripts on subscript.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you'll see all kind of things. Like in theoretical physics, you run out of Greek and you go to Latin and then you start making up symbols and. And then you have subscripts on top of those. So here, you could see you've got the Levi-Civita transformed, and you could see that this is the determinant of the transformation matrix, which is just this M. And then these are the transformations for each one of the terms. So this is just kind of the same thing as I wrote on the last page, just expanded out. And what happens here is that the inverse of the determinant is the determinant of the inverse. And it's just a mathematical property of the determinant. So you can kind of take this determinant from the other side and flip it over and create the inverse of it. And so this is the definition of a tensor density, is that in order to transform it, you don't just transform it like a regular tensor. You transform it, but you actually have to add in this determinant. In linear algebra, we call these, would call them pseudo-tensors in math methods, or pseudo-vectors, or pseudo-scalars. And that's basically what they are. For the metric, we have, you know, you could see that this goes like this, but with a minus 2 on it. And that is called the weight of the tensor density, is that factor of minus 2.
Where did the minus 2 come from?
That minus 2 came from the fact that if you want to do a transformation on the matrix, or on the, this isn't the metric. I'm sorry, getting a little bit ahead of myself. But basically what this is just some arbitrary pseudo, or some arbitrary tensor density, where they basically said that in order to transform it, instead of it just being the determinant, you've got a determinant to the minus 2 power. So it's not necessarily, I didn't derive that. I just said it that's just what it is. And so what happens is, if you want to convert a density to a tensor, you actually have to multiply by the determinant with this weight divided by 2. So what happens here is, for example, this G is actually the determinant of the metric. Okay? So in order to convert, Levi-Civita is a tensor density, and it just uses the determinant here, and just to the minus 1 power, then we would say that the weight is, for this side, we would say that the weight is to the 1 power. And so you would just have to multiply this by the determinant of the metric to the 1/2 power, which gives you this. Or if you want to flip it around and go from contravariant instead of covariant, then you'd have 1 over the square root of the metric. And the reason why we're using the metric is basically because the metric is going to help determine the coordinate systems here. And so what coordinate system you use is going to help factor into what metric you use, which factors into the transformation. And so I think that they explain it a little bit better on page 83. And what they say is, objects transforming this way are known as tensor densities. For example, another example is given by the determinant of the metric, where determinant of metric is G mu nu. And by taking the determinant of both sides of equation 248, which was this transformation matrix for the transformation of the metric. So you take the determinant of both sides of this, and you end up getting determinant of metric, and then the determinant of this transformation squared. And that's how they got the factor of this. And so then they said, well, that must be the weight of the tensor density. And then, I mean, one thing you'll notice is if you, as we go on further, is that when you do an integral, sometimes you'll see this factor of square root of the determinant of the metric in there. And the reason why is because of this tensor density stuff. And like, for example, dealing with the volume integral, it'll be in there. And so this Levi-Civita, and you can see we've expanded this out, is basically, if you take one of these and you contract it with its contravariant form, then you end up getting something like this, where you can see P represents the number of indices that are the same between these two, and N represents the total number of indices. And then you've got a group of delta functions, and you got all the different permutations on them. And you can see that this flips sign, like with S. And I think that I'm missing a Oh yeah, S just depends on the signature that you happen to be using. So whether it's time is minus 1 or it's plus 1 is going to determine what S is. So S is the number of negative eigenvalues of the metric, which basically depends on your signature. So this is just basically just telling you something to look out for as we go through this, is that you'll kind of see these tensor densities popping up. And the Levi-Civita is used a lot. It can be used to calculating determinants. It could be used to calculating something like a cross product. And it can be used for calculating something like volumes. So since it's used a lot, these things are going to keep popping up.
It's not the square root of negative g.
Oh, yeah, it is.
It is.
It is. Well, the reason why you might see square root of negative g or square root of something like that is because depending on your signature, you're going to get positive or negative determinants for the metric. Okay? So if you imagine, for example, using the simplest example, metric is equal to minus 1, 1, 1, 1. If you calculate the determinant of that, what is it?
Negative 1.
Okay. So now you got a negative determinant. If you take the square root, it's going to be imaginary if you don't put that in there. So, I mean, that's the only reason why you see that. Okay. All right, now the next thing, which is one of the hard things we're going to cover here, is deals with differential forms. And we're going to go from the differential forms to talk a little bit more about electrodynamics and then get into how do you do integration within this general relativity stuff. And so this is why I gave you guys those handouts to kind of read over to help understand what's going on. So the first thing is a differential p-form. And a p-form is basically, it's an anti-symmetric tensor, and it's going to have zero p. In other words, p lower indices.
And zero upper indices.
Yeah, and zero upper indices. So the only thing is it has to be anti-symmetric. So you've got scalars, which are zero forms, obviously no indices. Duals would be one forms. And the Levi-Civita would be a four form because, you know, going by the number of indices.
So you
mean 4, p? No, 0, 4. Yeah, because these are p forms, so this is like the number of...
Those are the p.
Yeah, so those represent p. So we also are going to replace this thing we normally think of as a cross product with something like the... Well, actually, we'll get to that a little bit later. But this is going to be the space of p-forms on a manifold are going to be given by this capital lambda with a p, and you could see the m for manifold term here. And so the number of linearly independent p-forms in n dimensions is going to go like n factorial divided by p factorial times n minus p factorial. This should look familiar from math methods because, you know, if you look at the different number of combinations you can get, they're going to go depend on the number of dimensions you can have and the number of indices you're using. And since these are anti-symmetric, you can't repeat indices. So you end up getting something like that. And so in four dimensions, and so this is the same thing as in the statistical part where we said you have p things and you can only do them n at a time, or n things you can only do them p at a time, something like that. So in four dimensions, so n equals 4, you've got one linearly independent zero forms because, you know, you go through this, p is equal to 0, so you divide it through and it's got to be 1, just 1. You've got 4 linearly independent 1 forms. In other words, 4 linearly independent dual vectors you can have. You've got 6 linearly independent 2 forms. You've got 4 linearly independent 3 forms. And you've got 1 linearly independent 4 forms, which is the Levi-Civita.
And the 1 forms, would those be like the equivalents of...
They're dual vectors.
Basic basis vectors?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those would basically be those. And as far as the 2 forms and the 3 forms, that's something completely different. So, if you've got A representing some P form, and B representing some P form of, you know, with Q indices, a Q form, then we call the wedge product of an A form and a B form the Q plus P form. So it actually adds up the number in the form. And so, for example...
That's not
Q dot,
is it?
No, it's not. That's just something that your little ink got on the page. So, what? For example, if you have two forms, okay, and you do a wedge product of the two, then what has to come out of it has to be anti-symmetric, since the two are anti-symmetric. And they can't repeat indices. And so there's only one thing that can come out of it, and that would be the Levi-Civita. Or if you take one of your duals and you put it with a, dual vectors and you put it with a 3 form, it's going to come out as a Levi-Civita. Just because of the rules and repeating indices and stuff like that. And so the wedge product of A and B, and these are all the different indices, you know, I'm not saying which ones belong to which, is going to actually end up giving you this combination because of the fact that you can't repeat indices and it has to be anti-symmetric. And so, for example, if you take two duals and you do a wedge product, then that's basically going to give you an anti-symmetric combination of the two, and you have the factor 2 in front of it because it's anti-symmetric, and it's basically going to give you A mu B nu minus A nu B mu, which is just like a cross product. So a wedge product is a generalization of a cross product. The difference is that a cross product only really works if you're talking about three-dimensional space. This can work for any arbitrary number of dimensions. And exterior derivatives, the next thing we want to talk about, in exterior derivatives allows you to differentiate P-form fields in order to obtain P plus 1 form fields. In other words, you're adding another layer onto your form. So let's say you have DA, which is... an appropriately normalized anti-symmetric partial derivative of A. And you've got all these different indices, and this is going up from, instead of just going to P, it goes to P plus 1. Then you could see that this is like P plus 1 in the partial derivative with all the other ones. And the reason why this works is because the partial derivative is the basis, right? And the basis forms are these 1 forms. So when you're taking this derivative, you're basically taking this derivative acting on something else, one of these other forms, to give you a higher level form. And the gradient is the exterior derivative of a 0 form. So in other words, here, you basically have the 1 form, which is the partial derivative, acting on a 0 form, which is a scalar, to give you a 1 form. And also, I mean, a lot of this stuff makes sense even if you look at it more general. The reason why, if you look at cross products, and the reason why they work in 3 dimensions is because you basically have a vector and you have another vector. And they have to be different. They can't be the same. If they were the same, you lose the anti-symmetric and it doesn't work. And what happens is you end up getting something else And like, let's say you take a cross product of something in the x direction and y direction, you can write it as a something something xy, which is a higher order form, or you could just write it as z, since that's the only dimension left. And so if we say something crosses and ends up going in a z direction, we could say it's the same thing as these other two. So all this works when you even compress it down to two dimensions. Now, if you take here, you're taking the wedge product, or sorry, the partial derivative, or the exterior derivative of the wedge product of two different one forms. And that's like a chain rule. Derivative of one with the wedge of the other minus to the p power the other one with the derivative with the wedge of the derivative of the other one. And so, obviously, not wanting to rewrite a lot, if you look on page 70, here they've looked at, on page 70, they have this thing, which is where you take a partial derivative of some dual vector, and you're expanding that out with the transformation involved. And you can see here that the part of it where you end up with the last piece, which is sort of the leftover garbage that you normally wouldn't deal with in flat space, that when you take this, you can actually contract it to this because you're taking a partial derivative of this derivative and then you're doing a transformation on the mu to get to mu prime. And so you could see that this is symmetric, but the exterior derivative is anti-symmetric by definition. And so what happens is the exterior derivative is a tensor, but the partial derivative isn't. So if you do an exterior derivative instead of that partial derivative, and you got this expansion, then you have something that's symmetric, because, you know, these two derivatives are interchangeable. But we know that this can't be symmetric, so therefore it's zero. It's not contributing anything to the form. And therefore, when we do an exterior derivative, it's by definition a tensor. And so it's a difference between that and a partial derivative. So it's not the same thing. Does that make sense? Another way of writing it here is you could see that they've got the exterior derivative of the exterior derivative of A. And that's by definition zero. Because, you know, these commute, and you know they can't be symmetric. So we set it to zero. So that's the one thing that's really coming about differently here, is that when you talk about these differential forms, they have to be anti-symmetric. If you're trying to solve this for what is this, you know that this is true, you can solve this by saying either that dA is equal to zero or A is equal to dB, in which case you could say that you take dA and that's going to be a second exterior derivative of B, which must be zero. And so there's different ways of solving it, since you know that the second exterior derivative is always going to give you zero. Okay. Now, the reason why I think they brought this up at this point is just to show you that there is this thing coming that is going to be something greater than a partial derivative, which is going to work like a tensor or a vector or whatever, and that's what we're going to be using when we're talking about space-time curvature. And that thing is going to be called a covariant derivative. Okay. Now, the Hodge duality is something that was developed to map a P form into an N minus P form. So in other words, it can take a one form and turn it into a three form. Or it can take a two form and turn it into a different two form. Or in a practical way of looking at this, go back to our example of the cross product. where you have your one form, or your vector, and you multiply with another one form, a different x vector and y vector, and you get xy, which is a two form, right? Well, you can change that into just one z vector. And that's basically doing a Hodge duality, because it just turned that two form back into a one form, because you have three-dimensional space, in which case that works. If you're dealing with four-dimensional space, a cross product doesn't work. Because if you take x and y, you take a cross between them, and you know you're going to get something orthogonal to x and y, how do you know it's z and not time? So this is really something special. And this is actually used a lot in electrodynamics, and we'll go into that a little bit more. But the way we write it is the star symbol means the duality. And these are also called duals sometimes in the literature, just to so you watch out. And the way it works is if you take the duality of a form, a P form, then it's equal to taking 1 over P factorial times the Levi-Civita contracted with whatever the form is. So if you had a 2 form, then it would be 1 over 2 times Levi-Civita and the thing, and so on. And so for example, if you take the dual of a dual, then you're taking this operation on top of this operation. The Levi-Civita contracts with the other Levi-Civita, and you end up with minus 1 to the S plus P times N minus P times the original one. And so you kind of get back to itself. And, you know, it makes sense that that should work, because if you take a dual to go from a one form to a three form, then you can go back to a one form. And S is the number of minus signs in the metric eigenvalues. So usually that's going to be 1 for a metric like that. But it can also be 3. But, you know, doesn't really matter much here. Odd number is going to be an odd number. And if you take the dual, again, this is taking the dual of the wedge product of these two. Basically, what that will end up doing is it'll take you from having 2 1 forms to having a two form, and then taking the dual of that takes it back to a one form. In three dimensions, it's the same thing as a cross product. So that's why mathematically we can define this as a cross product. Now, the reason why I handed you that stuff in electrodynamics is because of this. In electrodynamics, if you take this partial derivative, this electromagnetic field tensor is antisymmetric. And so by definition, it's a two-form. And so you take a partial derivative or a total or an external derivative of that, then you're basically taking a one-form and a two-form, and you're going to get a three-form. And then, but what's happening is we know that that's going to give you zero. And I say here, F is the two-form. I don't mean this whole thing is a two-form.
And DF is a three-form?
Yeah, DF would be a three-form then. And this, we know, satisfies half of Maxwell's equations. So in Minkowski space, all closed forms are exact. So we can say that FDA, or F equals DA, and if this is a two-form, then it could be the sum, basically the multiplication of a exterior derivative in a one-form. So A is a one-form vector potential. Or, if this is a zero-form, then that means that there's got to be some other operation in here to get it up to a two-form.
Can you define a closed form again?
Oh, closed comes from if you had... Where is it? Closed comes from this situation where we say that if the total, if the external derivative is equal to zero, then we could say that whatever that one form is, it's actually the exterior derivative and something else, another one form. So, for example, since we say that df is equal to 0, then that we could say that f must be the exterior derivative of something else. And that's why we say, well, that's how we get to the idea of a vector potential. And so if you take the dual of this, Hodge duality, then you get this equation, which, by the way, satisfies the other half of Maxwell's equations. So you take the dual of this and you get something else, and what happens is now you're taking the dual of this one form, which is the forecurrent, but when you take the dual of it and you go back, then it just disappears and it goes to 0. And so if you take the current equal to 0, then you can transfer from taking the field tensor to its dual and then taking the dual of that back to minus the field tensor. Actually, I should say that this should be the dual of the dual. But either way, all we're really doing here is just taking a Hodge duality of the field tensor, and by doing that, we get the other half of Einstein's equations. And you can, I kind of went over it briefly here, but you get the idea, and there's more details in the reading on that. All right, now the last thing I want to go over today is integration. And the idea here is that we want to be able to know how to integrate in curved space-time, which means that we're no longer dealing with the general coordinates we're normally dealing with. And so if you take in n-dimensional Euclidean space, that's what that is, you're integrating over n dimensions in primed, and that's a transformation matrix acting on your regular n-dimensional space. So the idea is that whatever you do in flat space, you transform it to curved space and whatever. So when you have the sum or the integral on some hypersurface, and what this means is that this is a map to get it to the real numbers, then the integral is going to map an n form omega to a set of real numbers. And so if this is a one form, then you're integrating it over dx, and so this whole thing is just going to be a differential form.
So the first line of your integration, that element of the Jacobian is a matrix, not absolute value.
Yeah. Yeah, it's an element of the matrix. Well, because what happens is you have to do the transformation for each term, from R to X, and that's going to involve theta and phi and everything. So you end up with a matrix of these things. Now, in one dimension, this is pretty straightforward, right? You got your one form, you have your differential form, dx, you integrate it with respect to that, and you end up with the one form. In more than one dimension,
when you integrate, you end up with a one form?
Yeah, because remember, it's like the opposite of a derivative. So if you, basically. Now, more than one dimensions, you might have something like volume elements. And volume elements are n forms. So your dnx is really the wedge product of each of the different dimensions. If you think about it, that's what volumes are, because you never have duplicates in the volumes. It's basically just taking each one of the different elements, just going through them. And so this is a tensor density, and therefore it's coordinate dependent. of what's going to come out of it, because it's really just taking each element and you're putting them all together, and they're anti-symmetric. And so you can also write this as if you're taking this wedge product of all of these external derivatives, or whatever you want to call them, and you're taking, if you take that, you can think of it as basically like you have a Hodge duality of this, where all I've done here is just said, well, I've put in just a re-expression of what this thing is. And we've gone from, instead of summing from 0 to n minus 1, we've got mu 1 all the way to mu sub n. I've skipped a lot here. I think they... That basically what they did was they used the definition of the wedge product in order to do this, you know, and write it out like this. And that definition was from like from here, if you just want to look at a simpler form of it. Or you can think of it from the wedge product as defined here. It would be a little bit more complete. And so they use the definition of the wedge product, but then they also use the definition of Levi-Civita in these permutations in order to get it in there. And so once you've done that, then this stuff here, you know that you're going to have to transform it. And so when you do the transformation of coordinates, what happens is the Levi-Civita is a tensor density. And so it's going to give you the transformation matrix, the determinant transformation matrix, and then the other Levi-Civita and the new coordinates, and everything else is going to transform over. So then this, you know, is the same thing as if you just take the square root of the determinant of the metric. And so that's why they have this term here as the square root of the determinant of the metric. And you could see here that you now have all the different volume elements in the primed frame. Well, the volume is the same whether no matter what coordinate system you use, so therefore they can just unprime it and it doesn't affect anything. And so what happened then from all this is that when we do an integral with the volume, you have the square root of the determinant of the metric, or minus the determinant of the metric, is equal to this volume element. So instead of integrating over dnx prime, you integrate over this. So when you do a volume integral, you have to include the square root of the determinant of the metric in there. And what happens is if you're dealing with flat space, this term becomes just 1. But if you think about it, let's say we're dealing with a spherical space, okay? Not even space-time, just space, just three-dimensional space. The metric, it looks like this, right? Let's see. Missing it. Yeah. Right? So the determinant of that metric is going to be this. And the square root of the determinant of the metric is going to be this. And if you want to integrate over volume, in Cartesian coordinates, it would be the integral dx, dy, dz. But in spherical coordinates, it's going to be r squared sine theta dr d theta d phi. And so it works. And you can do the same thing with cylindrical coordinates or any other coordinate system you want. And every single time, it's the way it works. So this is not anything new. It's just a different way of looking at it. And this is just a lot more general than anything else. And that's why it is that when we talk about studying relativity, what we're really doing is studying geometry first.
So over there where you had the B, the matrix, the bottom is R squared sine theta?
R squared sine squared theta. Because remember that the metric... here would be ds squared is equal to dr squared plus r squared d theta squared plus r squared sine squared theta d phi squared. That's how you would write the metric. Because if you want to find the distance between two points on a sphere, radially, you just integrate over r. But if you want to go around the arc, you have to basically have a fixed radius and integrate over theta. And then over phi, it depends on latitude. So this is the metric.
Bless you.
Bless you. So, yeah, so anyway, the idea here is that this is just how you would integrate in a general spacetime. And so now that you know how to do that, then you can basically define whatever crazy geometry you want. And you know that when you're doing an integral, it's going to be the right integral. Okay. All right. So any questions? Next week, we're going to start on Chapter 3, which is curvature. And the basic idea here is dealing specifically with non-trivial spacetimes and looking at what happens when you do calculus or differential mathematics on these curved spacetimes. And like I said, for the differential form stuff, it's not, you know, it's kind of a weird concept, and it's just not something that you're ever introduced to. So that's why I said, you know, read through that stuff on the electrodynamics with it, and you can get a better feel about where this actually comes from. Now, for your next assignment,
you
know, you've
given
it
to us already.
Oh, I did?
Well, chapter 3, 2, 3, 5, and 6, chapter 4, 1, 2, 5, and 6.
Right. Okay, well, let me write it down for everybody else then.
Okay. Yeah.
So everyone just wrote it down. Okay.
Somewhere we got it.
Yeah.
Maybe he's changed his mind.
No, I haven't changed my mind.
You have PS3 yet?
Yep.
All right. So we're not ready for it yet.
No.
Now, wait a minute. You said it was due 7-7. You changed it to 7-12.
I changed it to 7-12.
That's okay.
Yeah. Well, the reason why is because when I did my analysis of where we are in this stuff, I figured it'd be a good idea if I've gone over at least most of the stuff before it's due. And see, you notice I'm only assigning the problems out of sort of the beginning of the chapter, so that way if... you know, you should be able to get everything done without having heard everything. And for chapter 3, or problem set 3, there's, again, just a couple of them out of chapter 5 and 6. And then the final, it's probably going to be, I haven't decided 100% on it, but I'm thinking it's going to be like 5 problems out of chapter 7 and 8. Okay. All right. So that's it for today, unless there's any questions. All right. I'll see you guys.